Great pleasure to be here. So the object of study of my talk is a spaceflight close to surface in space-time. So I'm going to draw a picture here on the board, and the dimension is going to suppress by one. So for example, this is going to be a two-dimensional surface, and sometimes you'll bound a three-dimensional space-like region. Okay? And this is in the space-time, so four-dimension. And the goal is to find the value definition of the quasi-local mass for this two surface. Or you should actually imagine this surface is a sphere, topologically sphere. And this is a joint work with Shuntong Yao, who's the next speaker. And the later part is also joined with Pauline Chen. So let me start by reviewing some materials in general relativity. So the space-time is a Lorentz manifold with a Lorentz metric, which represent the gravitational field. And there's also matter fields on your space-time. And to derive the Einstein equation, you write down this gravitational action, where well, this R here is the scalar curvature of the Lorentz metric, and this L here is a Lagrangian of matter field coupled with gravity. And then just derive the Euler-Lagrange equation for this action, and you get the Einstein's field equation. So this R mu nu is the Ricci curvature, R is the scalar curvature of the space-time, and the right-hand side, T mu nu, is the energy-momentum tensor of matter density. So you can see that the right-hand side comes from the matter field, and the left-hand side is computed from the gravitational field, namely the Lorentz metric. So this is really a relation between matter fields and gravitational field. And the question is very simple. Suppose you just take a bounded space-like region in space-time. So for example, just look at a bounded region in our world, and we want to measure the total energy contained in this space-like region omega. Okay. And the point is that we happen to count contributions from both matter fields and gravitational field. Okay. Because we know both of them will have contribution. So let's look at the, first look at special relativity case. So this is a case when the space-time is Minkowski space. So you have a flat metric. And, well, you can take a space-like hypersurface and take this u nu here to be its normal. Right? So this space-like, so this is a time-like normal. In this case, because, well, basically the Lorentz metric is flat. So, well, when you measure energy, it's really energy from matter field. And therefore, for any constant time-like unit vector, so this is supposed to be an observer, then you can simply take the energy-momentum tensor of matter, okay, that's the T mu nu there, okay, and form this expression, which is the density, and then integrate this one along omega. And this will represent the energy intercepted by omega and observed by this T mu observer. And recall that this T mu here is actually a constant vector or Keating vector field. So that will imply this one form here is actually divergence free. And therefore you see that this energy in fact only depends on the boundary surface. So it doesn't matter which boundary surface you take. By this conservation law, well, the energy turns out only depend on the sigma here, which is the common boundary. So that's why the problem is reduced to a measurement on a two-dimensional surface. But this does not work in general relativity. Well, first of all, in general space-time, there's no Keating vector field. So you cannot really form this kind of expression. And, well, even if there's a Keating vector field in some special space-time, this will only count the contribution from matter field. So we call this T mu nu here only represent a contribution from matters. But we know our gravitational energy must have contribution. So for example, if you look at two bodies, and then the binding energy will depend on the distance apart. And that's a contribution from the gravitation. So this actually turned out there. Well, let's go back to the difficulty in measuring gravitational energy. So first of all, gravitation has no density. So unlike a matter field, where you have this T mu nu there that represent the density of matter field, and gravitation has no density at all, so can at best be measured quasi-locally. Okay, and well, in mathematics, it simply means that you take this Lorentz metric, and you can choose any you can choose a special coordinate to make the first derivative of the Lorentz metric to be equal to zero at this point. And secondly, the gravitational energy will depend on the underlying geometry. Okay, so the underlying geometry is determined by this Lorentz metric with the gravitational field. And this is distorted by the field itself. So this is actually a much more nonlinear question than the matter energy. And in general, there's no background, okay, unless the gravitation is weak or asymptotic symmetry. So in this case, the definition of total energy is actually possible. And so let me just, this is so-called ADM total energy in the special infinity, and also the bounded sex total energy momentum in the asymptotic null case. So let me just give you an idea of what it looked like in the asymptotic flat case. So in the case of when your space-time is asymptotically flat, which means that the gravitation field becomes very weak as you approach infinity. In this case, the definition of asymptotically flat space-time is simply there exists asymptotically flat space slice. So this is your omega here. So this is, again, a hypersurface in space-time. And on hypersurface, you have the induced metric, the space size, this is the Riemannian metric. And there's also the Schlesinger curvature, or the second fundamental form. And this is asymptotically flat if the complement of a compact set. So if you just remove a compact set here, and the rest of them is actually diffeomorphic to a union of complement of balls in R3. Okay, so in this case, there's only one n. But in general, so outside this compact set, this is actually diffeomorphic to R3. Okay. And there may be several n's. And on each n, asymptotic flatness simply means that the induced Riemannian metric is very close to the standard metric. So this is actually a decay assumption here. And also the extrinsic curvature of the second fundamental form satisfy a decay condition. And in this case, you can form these flux integrals, okay? Where the first one is the E, which is the total energy. So it's defined in this. So you take the derivative, the first derivative of your metric, but now with respect to the Euclidean, the background Euclidean metric. And this VI here is actually the hour normal of this SR. This SR here are the coordinate spheres of the Euclidean metric, HN. And you can also take the PIJ and form this flux integral here, form this integral here, okay? And these are PI, so I goes from 1 to 3. So you're working on this three-dimensional hypersurface. And you take a limit of them. So you get, you get four components, and this is actually a four vector. And this is so-called ADM energy momentum four vector. And it's actually proved that this vector here is always a future timeline full vector. Or the Lorentz norm of this vector is actually positive, and that corresponds to the mass. and under the dominant energy condition by the positive mass theorem of Shen and Yao. So let's now go back to our original question. Namely, well, we have this space-like closed two surface in space-time, which is a topological sphere. And we want to attach a quasi-local mass, and in fact, a quasi-local energy momentum four vector to this surface. And, well, in fact, this, the search for a definition of quasi-local mass is actually the first problem in Penrose's problem list. So he lists, in 1983, he lists, give a list of major unsolved problems in classical relativity. And this is the first one. And, in fact, many important statements in general relativity make sense only with the presence of good definition of quasi-local mass. For example, we're going to talk about the binding energy of two bodies rotating about each other. And more importantly, a good definition of quasi-local mass can actually may help us to control the dynamics of gravitational field, especially when you study the evolution equation, which is itself a hyperbolic equation. And the energy method is sort of the most important technique in hyperbolic equation. But, well, other than the total energy here, we don't really have a local description of energy for Einstein equation. So, well, so now we can ask the question, so what properties will qualify for a valid definition? Well, first of all, well, since we already know the answer in the asymptotic flat case, so, well, at least, well, if you actually define a notion and you restrict to the, this SR here, those coordinate sphere here, and you take a limit. And this limit here should approach the ADM mass. Okay. And likewise, in the asymptotic null case, this is well accepted a bounding mass. So the limit should approach the bounding mass in the asymptotic null case. And also this positivity. Okay. So under the assumption of dominant energy condition, which basically means the contribution from the matter field should be positive. You should be able to prove the quasi-local mass is positive. And also rigidity. Okay? So for surface in Minkowski space, where it's vacuum, or it's flat space-time, and there's no matter field, the quasi-local mass actually should be equal to zero. So you can imagine this is sort of a plotting problem. You're looking for a function that is defined on the set of all closed space-like two surfaces in space-time. You know what it looks like at infinity. You know for, well, on a subset, it has to be positive. And you know on another subset, it has to be equal to zero. Now find a function. And there are actually various attempts to define quasi-local mass. For example, give a list of names here, Hawking, Bonnick, Penrose, Huskin. But in this talk, these people use a somewhat different approach, but I'll focus on the Hamilton-Jacobi analysis approach in this lecture, and that's how we derive our new definition. Okay, so I'm talking about this Hamilton-Jacobi analysis of the gravitational action. So it's probably start with, well, I'm not quite sure about the history, but as far as I know, it's so ADM and Brown-York and Hawking, Horowitz and Kijowski studied this problem. So the idea is that you start with the gravitational action. Okay. And you recall that when I give out this gravitational action in the a few slides earlier, I actually didn't put it in the right way. If you take any textbook in general relativity, you know that in order to get the right equation, the right Einstein field equation, you actually have to add this extra term here. Okay? So now if we take a Lorentz manifold D here with boundary D, then the action actually should be of this form here. This is the extra term here.
Well, this extra term here is actually the integral of the trace of the second fundamental form, or the extrinsic curvature of the boundary.
And this term here is actually important because there are some contributions from the first term. And you actually need this term here to cancel the contribution in order to get the right equation. Okay. And so this is assuming that the metric and the matter field are actually fixed on a boundary of D. And we're going to apply this Hamilton-Jacobi analysis to the time history of spatially bounded domain. Okay.
So our D is going to look like this. So this is a four-dimensional domain. And each slice here is space-like. So D is union omega T. T is in 0, 1. And so you see that the boundary of D consists of three parts. So it's omega 0, omega 1, and also this B3 part. So this is a B3 part. It's omega 0, omega 1.
Okay. And if you apply the Hamilton-Jacobi analysis to the action, then the Hamiltonian on a solution, okay, on a solution of the Einstein equation, is actually a surface integral at the terminal time.
Okay, so this is a sigma here, which is equal to a boundary of omega 1.
And this surface integral is actually given by this expression. Okay, so I need to fix some notation. So again, let me actually draw a picture here.
So this is sigma here, which is the boundary of the terminal surface. Okay? And again, you have T mu here, which is the observer. So this is a future timeline vector in your space-time.
Okay? And you also U mu here, which is a future timeline unit normal vector to your hypersurface.
So both vectors are time-like.
Okay, and then you can take this T mu here and restrict this one here on omega 1. So this is your omega 1 here, and decompose it into the tangential part and the normal part. So the normal part here is going to be n u nu. So this is a part here that is normal to omega 1. So you restrict your t. T mu is a vector field restricted to this hypersurface. And this is a part that is that is normal to this space-like three surface. And there's also this tangential part here. This is n nu part here. And this is so-called the Laplace function. And this is the shift vector. Just do a decomposition. Okay? And the surface Hamiltonian is given by this expression. Okay? So you see that this is actually an expression that will actually depend on this T nu here, which is the observer, and also there's a U nu here, which is the uninormal of your space time region. And you recall in the case of special relativity, the energy was actually given by this, which also depends on an observer and the normal, uninormal vector. Okay. But now this is just an integral on sigma. Okay. It's given by this expression here. Okay. So here is n here is simply the Laplace function that appears in T. And n nu here is the shift vector that appear in the decomposition of the observer, but with these two with other expressions, let me just explain them. So this little k here, okay, is the mean curvature of sigma as a boundary of omega. Okay. So this sigma here is a two-dimensional surface sitting as a boundary of this three-dimensional manifold. So you can define the mean curvature. And this P mu nu here is actually the second fundamental of omega in space-time. Okay, and this P lambda lambda is the trace of the second fundamental form, which is the extrinsic curvature. And G mu nu, of course, is the original Lorentz metric. And this V nu here is actually the vector that is due to a U nu. So V nu is the hour unit space-like normal along sigma and orthogonal to a U nu. So this is your V nu. Okay. So there's actually inward normal, but you just just reflect it and you get the hour normal here. Okay. So this is the this is so-called surface Hamiltonian that just come from the Hamilton-Jacobi analysis of the gravitational energy of the gravitational action. So let me recall this N here is the lapse, and this N nu here is the shift that comes from your T. And this K here is the mean curvature of the surface with respect to omega. And these are data coming from the space I3 surface. And this V nu here is the hour normal. And then, the energy is just defined to be the physical Hamiltonian minus the reference Hamiltonian. So the physical Hamiltonian, of course, is just a expression that we talk about. This is the physical Hamiltonian. But you see that physical Hamiltonian actually involve this two vector field. And also, you need to find out what the reference Hamiltonian is. So where does reference Hamiltonian come from? Well, the reference Hamiltonian should actually come from the data. Okay, should come from data associated with isometric embedding of the time history of the boundary, reference space-time. In this B3 here into reference space-time. So you should really take this this time history of the boundary, and then embed into a flat space-time. Well, depend on your reference space-time is. It doesn't have to be the Minkowski space. You can actually embed it into an arbitrary reference space-time. But somehow this problem is actually an overdetermined equation. I mean, you have a three-manifold. If you want to isometrically embed into a four-dimensional space, you actually have six equations, but you only have four unknowns. So this is actually an overdetermined equation. In general, it's not doable. And therefore, but we still have to find a reference Hamiltonian. But somehow you notice that this reference Hamiltonian, this physical Hamiltonian, is really just an integral on the surface. And therefore, what people did before was take the isometric embedding of the surface, sigma, into R3. Okay. And this has been used to define the Brown-York mass and the Liu Yao mass. Okay. And there are also other works here. So instead of considering the whole time history of the boundary, you simply take the terminal surface here, so and isometrically embed into R3. And also you choose the right U mu and T mu. And there are actually important positivity that was proved by Shi Ken and Liu Yao. For the Brown-York mass and the Liu Yao mass. And here I use a very important theorem in geometry, namely, if you actually have a surface that has positive Gauss curvature, intrinsic curvature, then you can uniquely embed it into R3. Okay. So we take a different approach. Instead of taking isometric embeddings into R3, we actually consider isometric embedding into the Minkowski space. So let me talk about our new definition. Okay, so our new definition, the data will come from, of course, you start with a sigma here. That is in a space-time. So this is what we call a physical space. Okay,
and then we look for, then we look at a isometric embedding of this surface into Minkowski space. So we actually have isometric embedding theory that I'm going to talk about. Okay. And then in the Minkowski space, of course you have you have this Lorentz symmetry, and in particular you can take any Keating vector field, translation Keating vector field, so which is a future, it's a constant vector field in R3. And so all this data, so sigma is your surface, and your reference isometric embedding, and a constant vector in R3-1. And we define a quasi-local energy. Okay. So this quasi-local energy, of course, is still the reference, is still the difference between the reference Hamiltonian and the physical Hamiltonian. It's actually the surface integral that I define. Maybe I'll just write it down. Show you. So this is the surface Hamiltonian, which depend on T mu and U mu. Okay. Therefore, we start with this T here, and with that is, this T. Then the reference T mu zero is just given by this T here, okay? And then we're going to choose this U mu zero and T mu U mu, okay? So the data will actually come from this X and T, and we have a canonical choice of T mu zero, U mu zero, and T mu and U mu. So there are actually three new ingredients. Okay, so first of all, we have an isometric embedding of a two-dimensional surface in Minkowski space with a fixed expansion. Okay. So you notice that if you want to do isometric embedding, undergraduate geometry course, you know the first fundamental form of a surface. Well, it's given by E, F, and G. So there are actually three equations, right? But if you want to embed into a four-dimensional space, you actually have four functions. So you actually need to impose one more condition to make it a well-defined system. And therefore, that's what we do. We actually do isometric embedding with a fixed expansion. Expansion simply means that, if you move the surface in a certain direction, the area change is fixed. So we can take any, metric on this sigma here is a topological sphere, okay, and take any constant timeline vector T mu zero, that's the one we choose to start with, this capital T. And suppose rho is a smooth function on sigma that satisfies this condition, so it's mean equals zero. That actually corresponds to the expansion function. Okay. If you move a surface in a constant direction, the total change of the area should be actually equal to zero. And suppose the convexity condition holds on this rho here. Well, the reason is that you recall that in the case of isometric embedding into R3, you have to assume the Gauss curvature is positive in order to get uniqueness. And likewise here, there is a convexity condition that we need to assume. Then there exists a unique isometric embedding of sigma into R3-1, such that the expansion of sigma is in the direction of T mu zero is given by this rho here. And this embedding actually has a convex shadow in the direction of T mu zero in the following sense. So this is a surface in Minkowski space, right? And this is a space-like surface. And there's a very important property for a space-like surface in Minkowski space. Namely, well, you can actually take the projection of the space of the surface onto the orthogonal complement of any timeline direction. Okay? And the difference between doing this in Minkowski space and Euclidean space is that, well, in the Euclidean space, when you do projection onto some hypersurface, okay, the area always, or the distance, always get decreased. So you may not be able to get an embedded surface after the projection. But in the Minkowski space, when you do projection, you always get some expansion. So whenever you have a nice embedded surface upstairs, you always get a nice embedded surface downstairs. Okay? And we can do that so that, well, this embedded surface here, I call it sigma here, is actually a convex surface in R3. Okay, so this is an object that we are very familiar with. And so let me talk about this choice of gauge. So you recall our energy is defined to be and we already have this one here. This comes from the Minkowski space. It's just a constant vector. And we still have to choose this on both on the reference surface and the physical surface. Okay. So in order to be gauge independent of the three manifold sigma bounds, okay, we actually choose this U mu here to be the direction of the normal part of this T mu along sigma. Okay? So we have this timeline vector here. Okay? And this U mu here is simply another vector. So what we do here is we simply choose this U mu here to be in a direction of T mu, the normal part of T mu. So recall this T mu vector here is just a constant vector. So along your surface, there's normal part and tangential part. You take a normal part and normalize it so that it becomes a unit vector. And we can choose the same, in the same way, in the reference isometric embedding. So in a way, this U mu here, this U zero mu here is determined by T zero mu, and this U mu is determined by this T mu. And this actually has a very nice consequence. Okay? So in the Minkowski space, suppose we just take this to be T zero mu here, right? And we choose our U zero mu to be the one that is in the normal digression of T mu zero. And then we take this this data here and plug into this expression and compute the surface Hamiltonian. It has a very simple expression. It's exactly the total mean curvature of the surface downstairs. Okay? So you can see, as I say, well, you can always get the projection, and you always get a nice convex surface in R3. So there's a well-defined mean curvature along the surface. And this complicated expression actually gets simplified, and it's exactly equal to, well, this is about, this is 1 over 8 pi here. So this is actually a formula that we actually learned from a paper of Gibbons where he studied the collapsing of black holes. Okay. Well, so we know how to choose this U mu zero, T mu zero. We also know how this U mu depends on T mu. But we haven't chosen this T mu yet. So let's talk about this choice. So again, so we have a reference isometric embedding. Then this T mu here is actually chosen in the following way. Okay? You see that here we already have a U mu, T mu here. And we need to find out this a U mu here and also a T mu. And we claim that after you choose this data here, you can actually choose a T mu here, which is supposed to be the observer. So to transplant the observer here. And this T mu satisfies the following property. Well, first of all, the expansion of sigma along T mu 0 in R3.1 is actually the same as the expansion of sigma along T mu in N. Namely, if you move this surface here in this direction, And the area change is actually the same as if you move this surface here in this direction. So imagine T mu and T mu zero, they're both observers. So these observers will actually see the same area change moving this direction. Secondly, there's a T mu zero. T mu and T mu zero have the same left function and shift vector along sigma n and sigma r 31. So this is in a way, a canonical way to actually transplant an observer in your reference space-time to your physical space-time. And the reason why we can do that is because we have this isometric embedding theorem that fixes the expansion. So they actually have the same expansion in corresponding directions in addition to being isometric embedding. And then, after you fix this data here, then you can take this data to compute this T mu and U mu here. And this defines our quasi-local energy. Okay. And now I actually like to talk about an expression. It turns out this formula here, of course, when you write it down, except this part, this reference part is actually very nice. Okay. But somehow improving a lot of formula is actually more important to write down everything more intrinsically. So it turned out everything actually can be written down in terms of the mean curvature vector field of sigma in n. Well, not everything, except there's important. It turned out there are two important, two information. One is the mean curvature vector along sigma in the space time. And the other one is actually the time function. Okay? Namely, it's actually the, if you take the this x here, and you take Lorentz product with T. So this is what I call the time function. So this is really the time function you see on the surface. And you can actually express the quasi-local energy in terms of this data. Okay? So what is the mean curvature vector? Well, for any space-like surface in N, the mean curvature vector is given by this. So this is a minus K V nu plus P U nu, where K is, again, the mean curvature vector space-time. And then P is actually the trace of restriction of PRJ to sigma. And it is really the vector that if you take the Lorentz product with another vector, that will give you the expansion in that direction. Okay. Or for geometers, you know, this is actually from the first variation of area. Okay. And the important thing is that this H here is independent of the choice of these friends. So it's really, it's really uniquely attached to the space-like surface. Okay, and we assume this mean curvature vector is space-like. Okay, and then this mean curvature vector is actually a normal vector field. Okay, and you can see that our surface is a space-like two surface in space-time, and therefore the normal bundle actually has structure group SO11. So there's a unique light cone in the normal bundle. And then we can take this mean curvature vector here, and we reflect this one along the light cone. So we get another vector, which is dual of H. And when H is space-like, J is actually future time-like. So J is actually a reflection of H along the light cone in the normal bundle. And now suppose the isometric embedding is this x, and this t is a constant time-like vector. As I mentioned, we have this tau here, which is the time function on sigma. Okay, so that's exactly the time that is experienced on any point in sigma. And then you can actually compute the shift vector and the left function. Okay, and at the end, this is the expression. So we can actually use this canonical gauge condition that I just mentioned to find a corresponding vector in the physical space-time. Anyway, when you compute the reference Hamiltonian, as I said, the reference Hamiltonian is actually easy. It's really just a total mean curvature of the projective surface. But the reference Hamiltonian actually has this expression here, where this H here is actually is a mean curvature vector that I just mentioned. And then tau here is the time function. So after you do the isometric embedding, you pick up the time function there. And the sigma here is an induced metric. Okay? So for induced metric, you can calculate the gradient of this function and compute a norm. So this is the gradient score. And, well, for an induced metric, there's also a Laplace operator. So you apply to this time function. So this is Laplace rho square, tau square. And there's also this expression here that involve sinh, arcsinh. And also there's this J here, okay? So J here, you recall, is just the dual vector to H. And you notice that these two vectors are actually, you actually form a frame, an orthonormal frame for the normal bundle. So this expression here actually corresponds to the A connection of the normal bundle, okay? So this part here, well, in general, it would depend on gauge, depend on how you choose a frame. But because our mean curvature vector is space-like, so we have a unique way to choose a frame like this. And so this is a connection form. Okay. So you can see that this information will come from both the mean curvature vector and from the normal bundle. Of course, this part here only depends on the mean curvature vector. And you can imagine this the first term here, okay, which is the surface Hamiltonian. We can actually write it down in a similar way, right? So it's really the same expression, except you replace this H here by H0, and then, and it's J0 here, J by J0. And, of course, here you're talking about the connection of the normal bundle of the physical surface. So this is actually N. And here you're talking about the connection of the normal bundle in this reference space-time. So this is a rather complicated expression, okay? But, as I said, this is really a quasi-local energy. Okay. So this quasi-local energy here depend on a reference isometric embedding, and a T here. T is supposed to be an observer, okay? And then with this quasi-local energy, we can define our quasi-local mass. Okay. You recall in special relativity, if you have a particle motion, and if you want to recover the mass from the energy seen by observers, you can simply minimize the energy seen by all observers and take a minus sign in front of it, and that will give you the mass. And this is our mass. Yes? Right. Well, among all this, all those data are coming from X and T. In fact, there's actually a very simple formula for rho, okay? So as I said, this rho here is really the expansion, okay? And so this is really, you can really write it down as H0 dot with T, where H0 is the mean curvature of the surface here. But H0 actually has a very simple expression. Namely, this is isometric embedding into R3-1. You take the coordinate function, restrict to your surface, take the Laplace. So this is a very simple expression. And of course, this is Laplace of xt, which is minus Laplace of tau. So that's why this minus Laplace tau appear over there. In this Laplace tau, right? That actually come from the rho. I mean, in some cases it's a 10, but we don't have a general theorem for that. Yeah. So we can prove the positivity for this mass under this convexity assumption. And also the rigidity, namely for any surface in Minkowski space, this expression actually is equal to zero. Okay, and in fact, if you look at all different, after you minimize this one here, the minimum of this one here will give you the mass, and then the unit space unit timeline vector. Where this minimum is achieved, it's called T0. This is the energy momentum four vector.
Okay? So let me say a few words about the asymptotic behavior. I mean, I talk about the positivity and rigid. Well, I'm sorry, I cannot really talk about the positivity here. It's rather complicated. But let me just talk about the asymptotic behavior. Okay. So we show that the quasi-local mass approaches the ADM mass and bounding mass at spatial and null infinity, respectively. So what do I mean by that? Well, in an asymptotic flat space time, flat space time. I recall there are many different definitions for asymptotic flat space time. Well, the first definition is when you actually have asymptotic flat space time hypersurface. Okay. So this is the case of ADM. In that case, you actually have Euclidean coordinate at infinity, and you can take this SR here to be just a coordinate sphere. It's the one I just mentioned in ADM mass. In the case of bounding coordinates, okay, and in this case, there's a so-called retarded time here, and this retarded time slice is actually null. So there are actually null cones in your space-time. And there's also a coordinate R here, and we just take SR here to be the bounding coordinate spheres. So we have SR in the asymptotic flat case, and then SR here in the asymptotic flat case. Right? So this picture is like, so in the asymptotic flat case, you have this SR here going out to infinity, and this is T equal to some constant. And in the asymptotic null case, these correspond to W equal to some constant. And you also have this SR here that correspond to R equal to some constant. R here is actually the area radius, since 4 pi R squared is the area of the level set. And in both cases, we notice XR here when R is large is actually convex. It's actually very close to a standard sphere, and therefore in this case, this is a wild isometric embedding theorem that will tell you there's a unique way to isometrically this one embedding to R3. But the point is that we're going to consider this R3 here as a totally geodesic slice in R3 1. And then we can take any future timeline constant vectors in R3 1, okay? So, and therefore we can define this, we can compute this quasi-local energy. So we take this SR here, these are the surfaces in either the asymptotic null or asymptotic flat case. We take the unique isometric embedding, and we can actually take any vector in R3 1. But when we take the limit here, it's actually equal to T mu P mu here, where T mu, of course, is the original T here. And this P mu here is actually this full vector, which is the ADM, I'm sorry, it's a typo here, ADM mass in the spatial infinity case and bounded sex energy momentum vector in the non-infinity case. Namely, this quasi-local energy, in fact, gets linearized and acquire the Lorentzian symmetry infinity. So let me recall for you the expression Okay, so this is the expression here. And you can see that it's, the dependence on this T here is actually on tau. Tau is equal to, minus tau is equal to XT. So the dependence on T here is on tau. And you can see that this expression here is very nonlinear, right? So you have a gradient tau square, you have a Laplace tau square, and you even have a Laplace tau and arcsinh of tau here. Okay? So this is by no means this is actually a linear expression. Okay? But you can see, well, if you want to prove positive of something, that actually has to be somehow nonlinear. But somehow, all this nonlinear dependence actually disappear. And yet become a linear functional at infinity. So that's what we have here. So this T mu here is just a constant vector. And this P mu here is again just a constant vector. So in other words, yeah, the quasi-local energy actually gets linearized and acquires the Lorentzian symmetry at infinity. And well, in fact, this in fact, this calculation actually gives us even more information. Well, again, this is your n here. Well, this is inside n. And you see that we actually have an isometric embedding into R3. Okay. So this is actually SR here. And this is R3. That is can in R3 1. This isometric embedding we have from XR. And this XR actually cut together with the energy momentum flow vector actually coincide with the optimal isometric embedding that minimizes this in the top order. You recall when we're doing this, this is through a minimization process through this X and T here. Okay? And, well, it turns out that if you actually tilt this, so I was talking about this R3 here embedded into R3. However, if I tilt this one by boosting, so if I boost this one so that, well, let me just call this normal vector here to be E, P1, P2, P3. That's the total energy momentum vector of the physical space-time. So that will actually give you a boost. Okay? So instead of the original R3, if you just take a boost into this direction, okay, that will actually give you the top order of the optimal isometric embedding, namely the one that minimize this expression. But you can actually proceed to look for lower orders of this optimal isometric embedding. And the actual optimal isometric embedding is actually given by, suppose you can do an expansion like this. Okay, so this XR here is the one that is embedded into a totally geodesic slice of R3 after the boost. But you can proceed to calculate this X0 here. And X0 can actually be computed by considering the linearized equation of the Euler-Lagrange equation of this equation. So this expression is rather complicated, as you see. But you can still calculate the Euler-Lagrange equation for that expression with respect to X and T. Okay, and then you linearize this one here. And you can proceed to calculate the next order. And it turns out the next order is actually a biharmonic equation. So the leading term is actually double Laplacian on the sphere. And you can actually use spherical harmonics to solve for it. And, you can actually solve it step by step. And in fact, in the first step, so this is XR here. And when you solve this X0 here, it's already a surface, hypersurface. That is not on any total geodesic slice. So this is actually, so this one here is given by XR plus X0. So that would be the zeroth order, and then you can keep on doing this. So at the end, you're actually going to reconstruct a reference hypersurface in the Minkowski space. So putting together, this will give you an optimal reference hypersurface. It actually could be space-like or not. Okay, as you can see that there's a lot of Lorentz symmetry there. And we're hoping that this reference surface here will actually give us more information. So this will actually serve as a background. Right? So whenever you have a space-like hypersurface or non-hypersurface in your physical space, you can actually reconstruct a surface, hypersurface in the Minkowski space. That's supposed to be to approximate the physical surface in the best possible way. Okay. So let me put on the summary here. So we actually can use this isometric embedding of surfaces in R3-1 with convex shadow, it's convex projected surface. And also we choose a gauge, a canonical gauge choice on the physical surface and reference surface, so that they actually, when they move in the direction of the observer actually observe, they actually have the semi-expansion in the corresponding direction. and we get a new definition of quasi-local mass that is both that has both positivity and rigidity property. So under dominant condition, and convexity assumption is positive, and any surface in Minkowski space will have zero quasi-local mass, and it actually approaches the ideal mass and bounding mass at special null infinity. Okay. So I think I'm going to stop there. Thank you. I'm sorry? Yeah. 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 Yeah, I know there are expectations for this kind of monotonicity, but in fact, I mean, there's no reason for us to believe that there, because you see that the gravitational energy has no, gravitational energy has no density. So you're not really integrating something that is positive on a larger and larger domain. And in fact, the gravitational energy contribution could be negative. So this is actually the important thing of the positive mass theory, right? The matter power give you positive contribution. However, the gravitational power give you some negative contribution. But somehow they still get balanced and give you positive information. In the space, at least in the space-like region, of course, there's a bounding loss formula, which coming from the gravitational radiation, and that's physical, and then that's, but of course, that's about total energy. Yeah. Well, the technical part will actually go back to the isometric embedding theorem, but we haven't really think about it very seriously. Except, but we think a lot of things should go over there. Yeah. But as I say, I mean, we haven't really gone over the detail yet. But it should be doable when you replace the reference space time by a different one, the Sitter space. Or, I'm sorry, to? I mean, for closed surface, I mean, the limit, well, in the non-vacuum case, you should recover the energy momentum density. And in the vacuum case, you should recover the Bell-Robinson tensor. Yeah, that's what. Yeah. Quasi-local angular momentum, yeah. Well, we have a definition. Yeah, it's actually similar construction. You just have to replace the Keating vector field by a rotational one.